Thanks. Okay, so welcome to this podcast interview we're doing with Rob Keewer. Rob has previously worked for a World Anti-Doping Agency and now works for Global Athlete Organization. So we'll discuss some of those issues which cross over between those. So welcome, Rob. I just wondered if we could get started with you giving us a brief overview of Global Athlete and the need to represent athletes' rights and welfare and so on.
Yeah, the Global Athlete was nothing that I expected I would be doing if you asked me that a year and a half ago. Previously, I worked with the World Anti-Doping Agency, and in August 2018, I left the agency. And while there, I had always been a strong advocate for the athlete's voice and for the WADA Athlete Committee. And other athletes that had something to say in terms of how the anti-doping movement should change or what is working well and what's not working well. So after I left, I've actually planned to spend some time chilling out for a little bit. But then I was approached by an organization called Fair Sport, who was or is the organization that was protecting whistleblowers. One example is they protected Gregory Rodchenkov. And also did some assistance with the Stepanovs. They saw the values of sport eroding, realizing something needed to be done, and they felt that maybe an athlete-led organization could possibly be a solution to balancing that imbalanced power struggle within sport. So what we did was, I had a couple principles with them. The first principle was, if it's going to be athlete-led and athlete-driven, I would be interested. The funding cannot be attached to decision-making, so that all the decisions have to be made by the athletes. And I wanted to bring athletes together to kind of build a plan to see whether it was even made sense. And after a period of 2 days of brainstorming with athletes that we brought from across the world, we determined it was important to do. And that if change was going to be meaningful and really happen, it had to be led by athletes who were the number one stakeholders in sport. And that's how it really started, from a bottom-up approach. It's been the growth. I didn't think it would grow as quickly as it did, but I think that's attributed to it's really a grassroots bottom-up approach. It's we try to maintain truth to power, try to be always representing athletes' voices, and we never speak up or make statements or stand on issues unless we have the athletes' support and backing. So I think that's what we're doing now. We're trying to level the playing field when it comes to decision-making. Right now, you have athletes who have one vote around a table, and 1% of a vote gets you nothing. So we want to see a 50% vote on any rules that affect athletes, an athlete should have 50% of a say. Athletes want to grow sport. They want to be invested in it, and they want to see it flourish. And we believe the models in the United States, in terms of collective bargaining, have not hurt sport. They've grown sport, and both financially and in terms of being innovative in how sport runs. So that's what our goals are. And then, obviously, issues that affect athletes directly, whether they're individual issues or group issues, where they need someone to stand in front and stand up for them. And that's part of what we're doing on a daily basis.
Do you mind if I ask then about your own personal experience in that course of that transition over the last 18 months? Obviously, World Anti-Doping Agency is a really large organization. You had a prominent role there, and now you have a smaller organization, even though it has grown, but it has a specific focus on athletes.
Yeah, it's funny because the one of the funders of the organization, Jim Schwartz, once we started this whole process of establishing something from nothing, he was questioning whether I'd be able to do it and whether we'd be able to do it, given that I was in a large organization with really a mandate and being driven by a foundation board. And I just found, as I started to walk into it, it was the truthfulness, the non-political approach, the not being afraid to say something and being supported by those was a little bit of freedom that you can, you're not afraid of someone, any retribution coming at you. Of course, there are people that fire some targets, fire some shots at you. But overall, it's been fun. It's been a challenge, but it's been a really worthwhile cause to promote athlete rights. And I think it has lacked in the past because athlete commissions are a part of organizations. They do not have that independence to speak up. So the transition was quite easy for me, to be honest. And I've been having a blast doing it. It's been fun. It's been challenging, but it's been really, really worthwhile because athletes deserve more and they need someone to stand up for them to do more.
I'm very interested in how sports organizations have reacted to these initiatives, because we obviously know that, you know, the athletes commissions have been set up in the 80s in a way to prevent a union of athletes or, you know, that opposing power. So how has WADA or the IOC reacted to this new organization?
it's been interesting to watch, actually. When we first launched Global Athlete, the IOC Athlete Commission came out with a statement the very next day saying that they represented all athletes and there wasn't a need for another organization to come up. And we have a true belief that every athlete has an opinion. And so we were not going to shoot back at them. Every athlete should have a voice and we should allow that. So if that was their opinion, that's absolutely fine. And I would say over a period of a year, we were ignored, but I know they were paying attention based on people that I know with internally with the International Olympic Committee. And of course, WADA was paying attention as well, because we were taking some stands on some issues related to Russia, related to specific issues related to the charter and what we felt the athlete charter and what we felt needed to be done. I think what happened just recently in terms of Global Athletes standing up to make sure the IOC made an expedited decision to postpone the Tokyo 2020 Games. When they were asking athletes, they needed another 4 weeks. They were telling athletes to continue to train. And the rest of the communities were shut down. Like, communities were not, people were self-isolating. And a mixed message going to athletes to continue to train. And that was unacceptable. So we went strong. We went out with statements. We had athlete groups supporting those statements, making their own statements. And within 24 to 48 hours, the IOC on a Sunday was forced to go out and announce that the games had been postponed. So they were delaying the inevitable. So I think that was not just Global Athlete, but it was a really all athletes speaking up in terms of their rights, and they had to be listened to. And the second thing was the report that we released about 3 weeks ago on Olympic commercialization and player compensation, where we talked about collective bargaining. We talked about, based on the study that we did with Ryerson University and the Ted Rogers School of Business, that athletes were getting about 4.1% of revenues coming from the IOC. So that, I think that woke the IOC up a little bit. And since that time, they've debated our findings. We encourage that. We want them to debate our findings and tell us where we're wrong. But that requires opening their books. That requires providing transparent accounting. But we're happy to be proven wrong anytime. But let's see what you've got. So that's where we are right now. So I think we are being noticed, but I also think the important thing is not about us being noticed. It's about the transitioning of athletes having a stronger voice to change sport. So it's not about Global Athlete. It's about the athletes themselves. You know, you have Christian Taylor and Emma Colburn, who've started up the Athletics Association, which is a group of athletics athletes trying to have an independent athlete group, which we're fully supporting and working with it globally. So outside the world athletics, but independent from an independent athlete voice, which is what we're promoting everywhere.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Thanks, Rob. And just, you know, coming back to the issue around World Anti-Doping Agency, because I know that athletes do have some representation, but I always wonder myself what the athlete voice is, or, you know, when it comes to anti-doping, what is there a collective or single athlete voice, or is there a diversity of opinions? And, you know, some of the issues around the World Anti-Doping Code and some of the regulations which athletes have to follow, I do wonder what the sort of groundswell of opinion is about that at the moment among your organization and its members.
Yeah, I mean, I think the WADA Athlete Committee would be put in the same category as the IOC Athlete Commission, where their organization is, or the committee is, or the commission is there to represent the organization under the terms of reference. They are an organization or commission that's linked directly to WADA and has terms of reference and restrictions and limitations. I think what we've seen with the WADA Athlete Committee in the past, when Becky Scott was chair, it was individuals that stood up and against the structure, against the framework that was built. And that was tough. That wasn't an easy ask or an easy task for that committee to stand up against and to question decisions being made. The transition's made now, and Ben Sanford's in that position. And I think he'll be strong. But again, there's limitations in terms of having the freedom to speak out and speak out on issues, because you are really a part of the organization. We did a survey involving 400 plus athletes from 62 countries. And the athletes' comments were they lack trust in the anti-doping system internationally. They feel it's archaic and outdated. They're doing kind of the same things that were being done 25 years ago. And it's time to bring it into this century and to be more innovative in an approach. So I think there are some skepticism. It's not all wrong and not all bad, but I think some innovation needs to happen moving forward. And that's what we've heard from the athletes themselves, some change and different thinking.
Do you think there's a role then for, you mentioned the word collective bargaining in other previous contexts, but I know that in some North American sports, they have collectively bargained the anti-doping rules. Yep. And I think that reflects maybe some other forms of criticism, that one set of rules doesn't necessarily fit all sports and all different types of athletes at different levels in their career and so on and so forth. Do you think that, you know, maybe one of the innovations is a more nuanced approach which deals more specifically with a different type of sport in a different context?
You know, Paul, it's funny, because when I was working with WADA, I was a strong advocate for the code. I thought the importance of harmonizing things globally, because the system was pretty difficult before the code was put into place, where you had athletes that could be sanctioned for 2 years in one sport and 4 years in another sport, and then they could switch over to sports. So there was a lack of harmonization. However, I do buy into the World Players, who have a proposal to, which is a union of athletes, 80,000 athletes, to change things a little bit in terms of sport and in terms of sanctioning, and maybe making it sport specific. And I'll give you an example, which some athletes have brought forward to us. If you're a cross-country skier and you are sanctioned for 6 months, let's say you're sanctioned for 6 months in May, you serve that 6 months and you really haven't missed much because there's no snow. You're not out skiing with your teammates. You can still train at home. So that sanction really means nothing. And do we look at sanctioning in terms of missing events, missing qualifiers? Are those things that we should consider to make it a more level playing field? And that's where I think athletes need to be brought into the mix. There's always the rhetoric that athletes are engaged, athletes can comment on the code review, but realistically, athletes are not reading the code, they're not being engaged, and they don't have a 50% vote around the table. So that's, I think that's what needs to change. If you look at the WADA governance, there is a lack of athlete representation around the executive committee. There's a lack of representation around the foundation board. And we believe that there should be 50% athletes around those tables, making decisions on rules that affect them. And I think that's been lacking in the past and lacking now.
Okay, thank you very much. Just on a more specific case then, as it's been recently in the news, the Mark Dry case. I know that you've commented upon this in public. I just wondered if you could give us your thoughts on it just now.
Yeah, we're transparent. We're supporting Mark in terms of what he's doing and fighting for justice. We are calling for both the AIU, the Athletics Integrity Unit, and WADA to appeal the case that UCAD had put forth. I mean, I'm mind-boggled by this whole decision. We are very careful of what we stand for in terms of, especially in anti-doping, because it's such a difficult area to take sides. But this decision was absolutely, totally outside the spirit of the code. I mean, you have an athlete who was in a domestic testing pool where doping control officers came to test him and he wasn't there. The rules state that you have to have three domestic filing failures to move into the register pool where you potentially have a missed test. And over a period of 12 months, you need three missed tests to have an anti-doping, a potential anti-doping rule violation. Mark indicated that he was, when they asked him where he was, he said he went fishing. Okay, he went fishing. And then they found out that he didn't go fishing, that he actually went to his parents' house. Quite frankly, who cares where he went? Because it really didn't have a implication on the sanctioning that would follow. There was no sanction for domestic testing pool athletes. So whether someone in the UCAD decided no one's going to lie to me and I'm going to get you for this, we're going to charge you with tampering, which was eventually changed to attempting to tamper. Quite frankly, if Mark Dry would have told UCAD that he got abducted by aliens and was returned 2 days later, who cares? Because it's out of proportion, it's against the spirit of the code, and it has shown that that the organization itself has been out of touch with reality and athlete rights. And I don't think anyone with a sane mind that reads the case, that looks at the decision, would think that this is even proportionate to any sanctioning related to anti-doping. And quite frankly, we think it's a breach of human rights on what they've done with him. So more to follow as we move on, but we're going to be supporting him, and we're calling on athletics and WADA to appeal, because Mark, under the rules in the UK, do not have the ability to appeal. So Mark can't appeal this case. He's reliant on others to appeal it for him.
Yeah, I mean, over the last few years, I've become increasingly aware of cases where the outcome of the violation just does not really make kind of any logical sense compared to the extent of whatever it was, whether it was a contamination or maybe a stimulant that was taken out of competition that's still in the body in competition, or a recreational drug use situation. But it does seem to me that if there was a framework to assess proportionality against the impact and meaning, as you say, I mean, that's such a good example about the skiing season. So what is the point of a suspension during the off season? And you could probably say the same for even sports that have an 8 or 9 month season. If they still have a summer break or a winter break, then the sanctions more or less meaningless.
Yep.
But equally, I think some of the substances which people get banned for, they probably didn't change their performance. You know, they're in such small dosages or traces of a substance that you can't say that changed any outcome of any event. And some athletes who get tested positive and banned never went near a podium. You know, they're miles away from the front pack or whatever type of sport they're in. And so it just seems to me as if, this is kind of a question, that there must be a way to get almost a common sense decision. So yes, there's rules and there's articles and there's procedures and appeals. But there must be a way to say, hang on, let's just stop here, put this into context, accept that we don't fully understand the facts, but relate it to the actual impact of the substance and the timing in which it was taken.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
I mean, that's why I think the system needs to be looked at in a whole, to really look at what is the objective of anti-doping. Is it to catch the dopey dopers? Is it to catch the athletes that inadvertently are doping, or is it to catch the ones that are really trying to subvert and cheat the system? And I think that's where we need to reflect a little bit. And, you know, we go back to the Mark Dry case, for example. No one has offered him support in terms of mental health. No one has gone out to say, you know, everything is important. Other than us, we have offered that through World Players. But when an athlete tests positive or goes through a sanction, we just kind of throw them away. And that process is wrong, I think. They're human beings first, athletes second. And that's where we have to take this more holistic approach to anti-doping, where athletes' rights are put forward in the most important part of the whole process. And quite frankly, I think the system right now, the level of burden of proof that's put on the athletes is so high that athletes, as soon as they get a letter of an anti-doping rule violation, they're put at disadvantage. A lot of athletes don't have money to spend and to fight cases like the agencies themselves do that are asserting violations. So there's so many different areas, Paul. And, you know, let's take anti-doping laboratories. Is it right to have an anti-doping laboratory in a country that has that's high on the corruption index? I'm not so sure, because I don't think sport is as adverse to corruption if it's already happening in the country. So I think that needs to be looked at. Does it make sense? We have to be more creative in the way we move forward. And as I said, I'm working with athletes over the past year and a half all the time. If there's anyone I would like to go to war with, anyone I'd like to solve problems with, it's athletes. They're motivated, they're smart, and they get it, and they want to see change. And until we start engaging them in the solutions, that the rules that affect them, we're always going to be missing the buck. And that's where I think that's change needs to happen, because athletes want to have a say.
Yeah, great. Really interesting. Thanks very much. So I just, you know, want to bring things to a bit of a conclusion here. So the whole athletes' rights and athlete welfare, do you see that as you mentioned the word human rights earlier. Do you see it in the context of human rights and legal rights?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things we had done, I think it was in October or November last year, with World Players, Athletes Can, the German athletes, several athlete groups got together and asked for an eighth fundamental principle with the Olympic movement. And that was based on human rights, where athletes are, as I said before, humans first, athletes second. And it seems to be an athlete first speech to athletes, that they're unique. They're not unique. They're human beings first. And I think we need to really reflect on every area in terms of anti-doping rules, every rule that in terms of sport, and how that mirrors and supports basic human rights of athletes. And I think moving forward, we're going to continue to push that with the World Players. Because of that fundamental principle needs to be embedded in every decision that's made. Because I said, athletes deserve it. For too long, athletes have been used as products and have been really the unpaid workers, whether we pay them, compensate them. And the Olympic movement is a multi-billion-dollar business, and athletes get zilcho. That's not just financial rewards, but also involved in the decisions that affect sport. And so I think human rights is a huge element, and also basic principle in the UN declaration we want to see is the ability to organize. Every athlete has the ability, every human being has the ability to organize and to form collective bargaining. So we believe that's a part of what should be moving forward in the future too.
Okay, that's really interesting. I mean, overall, that's you know, a very, very helpful picture you've created about how athletes can contribute towards, you know, their own self-empowerment, to the role of global athletes and organization, and how all of this overlaps more specifically with what we are doing on anti-doping. So we really appreciate your time, Rob, and thanks very much for joining us, and good luck going forward with it all.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Thanks, Jörg. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
Cheers.